Hello everyone, this is Mike Quincy, Connecting the Light. My guest today is Dr. Mario Beauregard, who is currently Associate Researcher at University of Montreal, that is in the Departments of Psychology and Radiology, Neuroscience Research Centre. He is the author of more than 100 publications in neuroscience, psychology and psychiatry. He's here with me to discuss his latest book, which is called The Spiritual Brain, which is a neuroscientist's case for the existence of the soul. So welcome to the program, Mario. Are you there?
Well, thank you for having me.
Oh, you're very welcome. I know from the information you gave me that you conducted experiments on a group of nuns who allowed you to monitor their brains while they recreated an intense spiritual experience. Now, that sounds very interesting. So would you like to tell our listeners what was the goal of your brain imaging studies, how they were performed, and more interestingly, what the results were?
Yes, so the goal of the experiment was to identify the brain regions and also the brain networks involved in so-called mystical experience in a Christian sense. So mystical experience usually involve a sense of communion with the Judeo-Christian of God in the Christian framework. And it also involved other aspects like very positive emotional states, sometimes bliss, feelings of unconditional love. There's also a sense of alteration of the consciousness, self-awareness. So the frequently the experiencer will report the impression of being absorbed by something greater than the self. And so we wanted to identify the, like I said, the regions and the network supporting this type of experience. And about 30 years ago, some neurologists reported a few cases of epileptic patients. And when the epileptic seizures were located in a region of the brain that is called the temporal lobe, sometimes the patients were reporting spiritual and mystical experiences. So the neurologists concluded that there was a sort of God spot or God module in the brain located in this region, the temporal lobe. And so the goal of our experiment was simply to test this hypothesis. And so we used two different brain imaging technologies. One was the functional magnetic resonance imaging technology. And so this is a form of scanner that allows to visualize which part of the brain are active during all sorts of tasks. It can be a perceptual task or a cognitive task or an emotional task. And the other technique used was electroencephalography. And this technique allows researchers to measure electrical activity in various parts of the brain. And so we asked the nuns to remember and reenact the most intense mystical experience of their life as a member of the Carmelite order, because at first they told us that it was not possible for them to self-induce or to generate a mystical experience. The only thing that they can do is simply to enter in a sort of contemplative state, in a state of prayer. And then a mystical experience can happen or not, but they don't have any control about this. So we decided to use a strategy that was very similar to a strategy that we used a few years ago with professional actors here in Montreal. And where these actors are disciples of the New York School of Acting. So they use emotionally laden memories to act. And so we asked these actors to simply use very emotionally laden memories, like very sad memories and very happy memories, to self-induce states of happiness or sadness. And the strategy worked very well, and we were able to identified the brain systems involved in these emotions, and the brain systems identified were very comparable to what has been identified previously in normal people, not professional actors, while they were exposed to either pictures or even movies, movie excerpts. So we used a similar strategy in the nuns, and it worked very well because the nuns, they realized that they were able to a certain extent to recreate and to re-enter a mystical state by using this type of strategy. And we asked them to start practicing a week before the actual experiment. And so we effectively saw activity, electrical activity, and also metabolic activity measured with functional magnetic resonance imaging in the temporal lobe region. So this region was involved in both studies, but we saw also activations, very significant activation in many other portions of the brain, regions of the brain that are normally associated with self-consciousness, for instance, and also positive emotional state, and also what we call self-representation of the body in physical space. So to conclude, the results indicate that a mystical state is supported or mediated by various brain regions and networks that are involved in several aspects of human functioning, including emotion, consciousness, and also the perception of the body within space.
Yeah. So as a result of that, would you say that neuroscience can demonstrate the existence of God?
No, because when we use these brain imaging tools, the only thing that we can do really is to measure what we call correlates. So a correlate is simply a physical, biophysical phenomenon that will accompany changes in the subjective state internally. So there's no causality involved in this. So it's very hard to say that the changes observed in the brain are producing the experience or are reflecting something that is going on at a transcendental level, for instance. So the question of the existence of God is beyond neuroscience, no doubt about it. But in the book, I'm referring to another line of evidence, which is very interesting scientifically, and it regards the research that is done about the near-death experience. We have a few cases of people that have experienced the near-death state clinically in the context of a surgery. So I'm referring to the case of Pam Reynolds in the book. And this woman was operated about 15 years ago within the context of a surgery that is called a standstill. And in a standstill surgery, the heart is stopped and the blood circulation is also stopped totally. And the body temperature is decreased significantly, so you can preserve the tissues. Mm-hmm. And so in other words, the person is dead from a clinical point of view for a certain period of time that ranges normally between 15 to 60 minutes overall. Mm-hmm. And in her case, she was clinically dead for about 60 minutes. But what's fascinating in that case is that during the surgery, while her EEG lines were totally flat, which indicate that there was no brain activity detectable at that time. She had the impression of leaving her physical body and floating above her physical body for a while. And she was able also to draw very accurately some of the surgical instruments that were used during the surgery, and also to report veridically some of the dialogues exchanged between the neurosurgeons and also the cardiologist and the nurses who were there. And at a later point during her experience, she's had the impression of traveling very rapidly along a tunnel. And at the end of the tunnel, she met with deceased relatives and friends. And in the latest part of her experience, she met with a beautiful being of light. That's how she reported her experience. And for her, this being of light, which was very intelligent and very powerful, represented or was associated with her concept of God, of deity.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
after that experience, she was totally transformed psychologically and spiritually. And so this case, and now we have other cases as well, strongly suggest that mind and consciousness can continue following physical death, even if the brain is not functioning. And it also suggests that spiritual experiences are, or mystical experiences are possible even if the brain is not functioning normally.
Yeah. I think that's a wonderful conclusion that you've came to there, and I must say, having read your book, that you presented in a very fair manner, because although you have your own path of beliefs here, you do credit to other people that have a different view, and you, in effect, discuss it in your book by putting your own views forward. I think that's excellent. So I think it's a very good book to read in that sense. It's very balanced. Now, just continuing on with the question of God, is there such a thing as a God gene?
Well, we now know that in behavioral genetics that very complex behavior and mental functions, like, for instance, various types of emotion or cognitive processes like memory or other, any other type of human experience, are related to several hundreds and very often thousands of genes that are interacting between between themselves. And so it's very clear that something very very complex like spirituality and the impression of being connected with God, for instance, should also be associated with many, many hundreds or thousands of genes. And so the short answer to this is no, there's no single God gene. And even the author of this book, The God Gene, Dean Hammer, molecular geneticist at the NIH in the United States, backup with regard to his initial position, stating that there was, he had to identify a single gene related to this experience, because, in other words, it's way too simplistic. So it's a form of extreme reductionism, and the gene that he identified was actually related to the production of chemical messengers in the brain that are called monoamines, and they involve various chemical messengers, like, for instance, serotonin. Serotonin is involved in mood regulation. It's also involved in all sorts of behavior, like and functions, like sleep, for instance. And it's one of the main chemical messengers also implicated in spiritual experiences. Because with psychedelic drugs, this is the main neurotransmitter involved.
Right.
And so it is, there's a correlation between the gene that Hammer identified and spirituality, but you cannot reduce, of course, spiritual experiences to the activity of these genes. So, because it's a gigantic leap in terms of scientific evidence, because the evidence are not there. It's you cannot, there's no causality involved, but only a statistical correlation, and the correlation that Hammer found was very weak. So we have to be very careful when we want to relate very specific genes and very complex functions like spirituality, for instance. And like I said earlier, now Hammer is saying that, of course, spirituality and spiritual experiences, since they're very complex, they must be related to the activity of probably thousands of genes.
Yes. Would you agree with some people who get their information from different sources that there is a central energy somewhere in our universe which is the source of the energy we call God? So would you then believe, or have you found, that each of these cells has its own consciousness, and they in effect form your own God self? Would that make any sense to you?
It would, but of course it's very hard to demonstrate this scientifically. So it's at this point in time, with regard to our science, it's a matter of personal belief and also of personal experiences. Because sometimes people will, like in the case of near-death experiences, for instance, some experiencers report information regarding the original source of the universe, and so which is very, very closely related to our concept of what the Western concept of God. So, but there's no way to verify scientifically if their experience is valid or not, if it's a delusion or an hallucination, or so. It's it's very touchy.
I can imagine that. Now, looking at this question of God again, because it won't go away for a minute or two, is there such a thing as a God module in the brain?
Well, based on our own studies and also on the clinical study that I was discussing earlier, I would think that the that there's no single God spot in the brain, but that there are rather a complex network involving several brain regions that are implicated in what we call spiritual or mystical experiences. And among those regions, the temporal lobe seems to play an important role. But the problem in neuroscience is that very often when the you see an activation using a brain imaging technology, the researchers will conclude that the function that is studied is produced by the activation of the region. So that this is a big, in my view, this is a big mistake, because, like I said before, there's only correlation that is involved in these studies and not causality. So I would say that the temporal lobe is involved in the mediation of spiritual and mystical experiences, but this region does not create this experience per se.
Would you say then that it would be reasonable to compare our brains to a highly sophisticated computer?
Well, it depends on the perspective, because if you take the case of cognitive processes like memory, for instance, and also mathematics, you know, computers and brains can perform operations that appear at first sight quite similar. But in reality, the design of the brain, biological design, is very different than that of a computer. And so in the brain, you have what we call serial and also parallel computations, but the operations are quite different, because in a computer there's no propagation of nerve impulse, for instance, related to various chemical messengers and stuff like that. So it's very different. And for me, the most crucial difference is the fact that there's no self-consciousness involved and no spiritual essence in a computer compared to a human being. So this is a dramatic difference.
Yeah. So is the mind then an illusion that is created by the brain?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the mainstream view in modern neuroscience. So many Nobel Prize winners support this view. So so they will say that, for instance, all your joys or your sorrows or, you know, your impression of being a self are simply illusions created by the brain. But if there are certain experiments and lines of evidence that suggest otherwise, so I already spoke about near-death experience, but there are also other lines of evidence suggesting that it's not what we feel subjectively is not an illusion. You can take, for instance, the case of a placebo effect. In the placebo effect, the biological effect is determined based on the expectations and beliefs of the patient about the treatment. So it can be a sugar pill, for instance. And now we have many very interesting brain imaging studies that have been done during the last decade showing, for instance, that a placebo treatment can significantly increase the production of another chemical messenger that is called dopamine. And dopamine is the key chemical messenger implicated in motor functioning. And there was a study done a few years ago in Canada, in Vancouver, actually. And the study showed that in Parkinsonian patients showing a very intense destruction, very marked destruction of the nerve cells producing this chemical messenger, dopamine, well, the patients who responded most to the placebo treatment started to produce dopamine like normal healthy subjects, normal people. So it's very obvious if you study this experiment and other experiments alike that what we believe, what we think, also our volition can significantly influence the electrical and chemical activity of our brain. And so all the mental processes and the mental states that are part of our psychological life are very important and exert a very marked influence on brain activity. So they cannot be, these processes cannot be systematically reduced to electrical and chemical processes in the brain because they exert a very important influence on brain functioning. So this is, these facts are very difficult to interpret within a materialistic framework.
Yes. So what you're saying, in fact, I believe, is that placebo actually proves the power of thought, and it's powerful enough to enable us to self-heal.
Yes, and it's the same thing in psychotherapy. So when you do a psychotherapy and you, for instance, in cognitive behavioral therapy, the therapist will work at the cognitive level, and the therapist tried to help the client to reframe her cognitive schemas or beliefs about herself and also about her life and so on and so forth. And just by doing this, you will notice after the therapy major changes in terms of chemical activity in the brain. This has been demonstrated over and over now for about 10 or 15 years with brain imaging technologies. And so it's very possible to change what's going on in the brain and your brain simply by using all sorts of mental strategies. This is very well established now.
You were talking earlier on about people who had epileptic fits. Would that mean that they were experiencing possibly delusions which are created by a misfiring brain?
Mm-hmm. Well, in certain cases, clearly, epileptic seizures are associated with delusions and hallucinations, depending on the cases. But in rarely, like I said before, the epileptic seizures sometimes will be associated with religious or spiritual experiences when they are located in the temporal lobe region that we talked about earlier. But in those cases, it does not mean that the experiences are delusions created by misfiring of neurons in the temporal lobe region. Rather, it suggests that the temporal lobe might be involved in spiritual and mystical experiences. So it's a different view about such findings.
Right. this might be a good time to ask you then, are the mind and brain identical?
Well, based on all the series of evidence that I present in my book, I would say that no. I would say that mind and consciousness are using the brain in order to reach certain goals. But the brain, in this view, acts more like a TV set or a sort of transducer or transponder for psychological life. So this is why it's possible to clearly influence the functioning of the brain at will. And it's also possible to alter the functioning of the brain electrically or chemically in order to have access to other realms of experience. For instance, you can use certain psychedelic drugs and you will alter the regular chemistry of your brain, and in doing so you will be able to have access to a totally different type of experiences, and in that case the experiences are not necessarily pure hallucinations. They can have a very deep and genuine basis, because sometimes the people who ingest these compounds will be transformed psychologically and spiritually for the remainder of their lives. So so that's one way of altering the you know, the functioning of the brain. And so this is why I say that mind and consciousness are not the same as the brain. And if we go back to the case of Pam Reynolds, clearly this case suggests that mind and consciousness and also self self-awareness are distinct from brain activity.
Yes, yeah. So
we have only a few anecdotal cases yet, but if you study these cases, they suggest strongly that this is so. However, we need to conduct new experiments, for instance, using a standstill procedure, the one I was talking before. So I'm right now involved in a research project with other researchers to study the people who undergo standstill surgery. So we're going to study these people before and after surgery to see if they can have a near-death experience. And also during the period of clinical death, during cardiac arrest, we're going to try to see whether these people can detect electronic targets that will be placed in the operating room to be able to try to demonstrate relative independence of mind and consciousness with regard to the brain.
Oh, that's great. Certainly many people have had that experience of being out of the body and reporting the sort of details that you mentioned. Now, does it follow, in light of your experiments, that you believe that human beings have a spiritual nature, even one that survives death?
Yes, absolutely. Based on all the evidence that are discussed throughout the book, and also based on personal experiences that I've had since my childhood, I would respond yes to this question. Human beings, in my view, are not simply very sophisticated biological robots determined by their genes and their neurons, but they are more, I would say, spiritual beings inhabiting physical bodies and using the physical brain.
So can we find the answers to human nature in genetic programs?
I don't think so. Not at all. I would say that it's much more interesting and promising to investigate mind and consciousness during a state of clinical death, because it's that way we can learn much more about the true nature of human beings. But I don't think genetics is based on the materialist paradigm a lot, and many researchers involved in this field are extremely reductionist, so they are trying to simply, you know, reduce very complex functions, including spirituality, to the activity of a few genes, and this is, to me, very misguided, and it won't produce any good results in terms of the future.
Yes. So I believe you would go along with the idea that the present state of the universe is best interpreted as a product of intelligent causation or design.
Yes, I think that I don't necessarily believe in the intelligent design view, because it's not really a theory, but I'm more believer in the theism, and so I would think that that there was a source, a very intelligent source at the origin of everything in the universe, and that all the basic laws were there right before the beginning, and so you don't need necessarily a constant intervention of this being, if you will, or this source of consciousness and energy all the time, because all the basic parameters, fundamental laws, were there right at the origin. that's how I see this this question at the moment.
Right. So now, I believe some people in your line of interest have difficulty in accepting the idea of free will. What do you think about that?
Well, in my lab, during the last 10 years, we've done a series of studies about what we call emotion regulation. And in emotion regulation, you try to induce externally an emotion in your subjects, and by using either static pictures or film excerpts, and then you ask them to use a very specific strategy to reframe, for instance, the content of the or the context of the emotional stimuli that are presented, and they have to do this in a very intentional fashion. So these studies that we've done in our lab clearly indicate that it's possible to systematically influence the way the emotional portion of the brain will react to the stimuli you are presenting. And this is done for subjects in a very intentional fashion, but also using self-consciousness. So, for instance, you can teach your subjects to learn mindfulness, for instance, which is a central technique in various forms of Buddhist meditation. And in mindfulness, you become like a detached observer of what you are observing out there in the external world. And so simply by doing this on a volitional basis, you dramatically influence the way the emotional regions of the brain will process the information and react also to the stimuli that are presented. So it's very clear that you can influence volitionally what's going on in your brain based on our research, but also on other research projects that have been done by many other research teams.
Yes. So would you say then that people who have unreasonable fears, say one that's pretty common, the fear of spiders, should be able to remove that fear themselves?
Well, we did. Yes, exactly. We, a number of years ago, we did a study using cognitive behavioral therapy with people, patients suffering from arachnophobia. And in the therapy, they were asked to try to re-examine their beliefs about spiders, and we brought an expert from the Insectarium of Montreal to our lab, and this expert demonstrated to our patients, they were 13 women, that their beliefs were totally misguided, you know, about spiders. For instance, a spider cannot detect you visually at a certain distance, you know, after a few millimeters. It's not possible. Right, yeah. So the spider cannot also, you know, create a plan to attack you at a certain distance. And these beliefs are totally silly and irrational. And the patients knew that, but they didn't know how to change this this form of reacting. But in four sessions, we were able to taught these patients to hold various types of spiders, including a giant tarantula, after only four sessions. And
really?
We used functional magnetic resonance imaging to scan them, these patients, before and after this therapy. And before, of course, when we were showing them film excerpts of spiders in motion while they were lying down in the scanner, they were generating very fearful response at the brain level. So we were seeing very robust activations in the brain regions involved in the detection of emotional stimuli, like a region that is called the amygdala. And this form of reaction has been called emotional hijack by Daniel Goleman, the psychologist who wrote Emotional Intelligence. So these people were not able before therapy to change anything. So to come back to your question, they were not able to exert a volitional action. But after therapy, when we showed them very similar film excerpts, their brains were not reacting anymore the same way. They were reacting more like the brains of normal, healthy people. And so the therapy overall took only a month. So this is a very dramatic change in terms of brain activity, and it shows that you can exert a very important self-regulation of your own brain activity simply by changing your attitudes and beliefs about various events or various animals or objects.
Mm. Well, that must be very useful. Now, area that often crops up is the born-again experience, where they become aware of another spiritual dimension to their lives and their choices. Have you any explanation for what actually happens?
Well, I've not investigated this question yet, but I know that a few other researchers are interested in this issue, like, for instance, Gary Schwartz at University of Arizona. And the only thing I know is that when the mediums, for instance, or the channelers, have the impression of contacting in another reality, we see very important changes at the brain level, at least electrically, because this is the technique, the EEG, that has been used by Dr. Schwartz so far. So, but to date, it's not been very well studied yet. So I'm a bit careful about this because I don't know much about this question.
That's fine. I'm digging out some questions here that I know certainly interest me, and possibly our listeners, who, by and large, are conversant about spiritual matters. I'm sure they're getting along fine with what you're talking about. Now, would you say in that event that religious, spiritual, or mystical experiences actually change lives, or have the ability to change lives?
Yes, there are many studies that have been done so far with questionnaires and various types of scales showing that these experiences can induce very long-lasting effects regarding personality and psychological life, and also spirituality, of course. So there was a very important study that was done in the 60s and 70s in the UK, and this study was led by a famous zoologist, Sir Alistair Hardy, and he collected over 4,000 cases of self-reports of intense spiritual mystical experiences, and it was very clear that these experiences are quite common in the normal population in the Western world, but also in the Eastern world, and that Many studies since then have, in these studies, the researchers have followed the people who were reporting these experiences, and now we have many studies demonstrating that these experiences very often will lead to major changes in terms of personal beliefs and values, also in terms of attitudes and toward others. So, for instance, people will report, a greater level of unconditional love and compassion, for instance.
Yeah.
And their sense of self also changes dramatically following these experiences. And very often, they will their fear of death will vanish. So many important changes are normally associated with these experiences.
Right. Now, in your book, you give quite a bit of space to the use of what is called the God Helmet. What I'd like to ask you is, through that, can you induce a spiritual experience? How has it been a benefit to you?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say that it's possible to, certainly possible to influence the way the brain is functioning and to induce changes in terms of electrical and chemical activity that will be, that will lead to a greater receptivity for spiritual, mystical experiences. But it's not the stimulation, the brain stimulation itself that will induce directly the experience. It's more that you will produce a change in terms of brain activity, and this change will favor such experiences. So in the case of Michael Persinger, Persinger reasoned that since the temporal lobe seems to be a crucial region involved in these experiences, then it should be theoretically feasible to induce such experiences simply by stimulating the temporal lobes. But in the case of Persinger, he's very materialistic and very reductionistic, and for him, these experiences are simply the product, the byproduct of misfiring neurons in the temporal lobe region. So that's his theoretical starting point. So he did studies with this the so-called God Helmet that he created more than 20 years ago. He did a series of experiments, and in these experiments, he and his colleagues reports that the subjects who participated following the stimulation, they reported all sorts of spiritual, mystical experiences, including even near-death experiences. And so he's been claiming that for over two decades now. And a few years ago, a Swedish team attempted to replicate his findings. And they noticed before doing the experiment in Sweden that Persinger never controlled for the placebo effect or the suggestibility of the subjects. And they also noticed that very often he was using his own students and the students of his psychology department. And he was also giving, grades, additional grades for various exams if they accepted to participate in this experiment. So, in other words, there appear to be a number of major flaws in these experiments. And so the Swedish guys tried to control for all these flaws, including the placebo effect. And so at the end, they concluded that the electrical stimulation of the electromagnetic stimulation of temporal lobes was not inducing at all any significant spiritual experience. And so this created a controversy, and the question is not settled yet. In my case, I would say that the temporal lobe, based on the clinical findings with the epileptic patients that I was alluding to earlier, probably the temporal lobe is involved in the mediation of these experiences, but it's not very easy to induce systematically and repeatedly a very complex mental phenomenon. So, for instance, in Montreal during the 30s and the 40s and even the 50s, Dr. Wilder Penfield, the neurosurgeon who treated the Montreal Neurological Institute, that did a series of stimulation experiments of the brain with many patients, and the success, the rate was only 6%. So he was able to induce, for instance, vivid memories to memory retrieval for only 6% of the patients when he was stimulating certain areas of the temporal lobe. Because right. temporal lobe is also involved in memory retrieval. So you see, it's very, very complex. And so I doubt seriously that it's possible to induce in a systematic fashion spiritual experiences. However, based on the evidence, I think it's possible to modify the functioning of the brain activity in order to create a greater receptivity to such experiences. But we don't have full control over these experiences. So even though, for instance, you ingest a psychedelic drug like LSD and you become more receptive for these experiences, it does not mean automatically that you will have a very intense mystical experience. So it's possible to change to create, if you will, optimal conditions, yet there's no guarantee that it will succeed.
Yes, yes. Oh, that's very interesting. Now, Mario, we've been having such a good chat here. The time has flown by. Mm-hmm. The program ends 5 minutes to the hour. I'd like to give you a couple of minutes to tell our listeners again the name of your book and where they can obtain it. And then I need the last minute to announce my guest for next week. So would you like to just take a minute or two and tell our listeners what they can do?
The name of the book is The Spiritual Brain. It's published by Harper One in the United States. And it's you can find this book on Amazon. So it's possible to find it in the United States and Canada, but also in UK. And now in various other countries. So it's the easiest way, I think, to get the book.
Right. I gather you don't actually have your own website at this time.
Well, I have a website for my research lab, but I don't have a personal website.
No. Okay, that's fine. I just wanted to make sure. Only there may be some people that would be interested to see it if you had one. At this stage, Mario, I have to thank you very much for coming onto the program. It's been a very interesting talk. And as I said at the beginning, I've read your book, and I think it's extremely well laid out. And your argument, if you like, for your own beliefs, I think is very strong. So thank you very much for coming onto the program.
Thank you.
And I will now announce to my listeners that next week, subject to being able to pre-record the program, because my guest also runs his own radio station, I will have Ross Hemworth, who is the managing director of Glastonbury Radio in England. He's well versed in many of the subjects that my guests come and talk about. He's particularly interested, I think, in matters of UFOs and ETs, so it should prove to be a very interesting program. So I'll thank you for being with me today, and I do hope you can be with me next week. God bless you all.